We made USAA insurance for veterans like James. When he found out how much USAA was helping members save, he said,
"It's time to switch."
We'll help you find the right coverage at the right price. USAA. What you're made of, we're made for. Restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Boys in the Band podcast. But before we get into this one, we've got a quick message from our sponsors. Now, we know that out there, we've got lots of musicians, we've got lots of producers, fellow podcasters even listening into these episodes. And I'm sure there's plenty of you out there who deal with audio files on a regular basis as well. And if you do, you'll know that it's easy to get lost amongst all of the various demos and versions of a file.
Yeah, indeed. And we've been in touch with a new tech startup called Aux, who are looking for beta testers for their software. Anyone who signs up gets 10 gigabytes of free storage and the ability to easily share their files with collaborators and discover like-minded creators.
Yep, so if you've been frustrated by the clunkiness of storing and sharing music, then head to aux.app/boysintheband. That's aux.app/boysintheband, all one word. Sign up today to become a beta tester for their software and get that 10 gigabyte of free storage.
Yep, get on that. And thanks very much to Aux for supporting the Boys in the Band podcast. Speaking of which, let's get on with this week's episode. Hello and welcome to the Boys in the Band podcast. I'm Richard Gallagher.
And I'm Peter Smith. And on this episode, we're joined by Reggie Youngblood, lead singer of Black Kids. Rich, for his first ever podcast appearance.
Yeah, we were duly honoured, weren't we?
Very much so, yeah. A true Noughties Indie exclusive for you. And yeah, we loved rewinding the clock with Reggie. As we say in the pod, me and Rich were at their second ever UK gig. I don't know what we were doing on the first night, but that was still a gig I can remember now. So very good to reminisce with him about that. And of course, they've just been touring again, Rich, haven't they, over in the UK?
Yeah, indeed. They just had their Hugs and Kisses tour over in the UK, where they performed that debut album, Party Traumatic, in its entirety. Great to see that there's still a lot of love for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, lots of love for their brand of indie pop. And, one thing I didn't mention to him, because I thought it would be far too geeky to say, but MSN Messenger, Rich, were you a MSN Messenger man back in the day?
Yeah, of course.
Everyone was, yeah. And the trend then was not to just have your name, but to have something cool and funky and clever. And I do remember nicking Black Kids song titles quite frequently for my MSN Messenger song title name. My name on MSN Messenger, just to try and be cool, really.
Mine were always lyrics as well. Yeah, mine were always lyrics. I'm racking my brains now. I definitely had a Jamie T lyric for ages. I can't remember what one it was, but those are the days, mate.
I'm not going to teach your boyfriend how to dance with you. I thought that was very cool when I was 19, 20, something like that. Anyway, here's a clip of Reggie, just as a teaser, talking about those quirky song titles that they had.
Often I would come up with the title first, with I'm not going to teach your boyfriend how to dance with you, and then I'll just be like, all right, that's a title I'm going to use for something, and eventually the song would come to me. A title is a great impetus for a song. It just kind of, if you're lucky, the song would just write itself. If I only had the titles to go by, I would be like, well, this is obviously a ridiculous person, so I'll risk $20 on this, I suppose.
Curious song titles, and you certainly got good value if you did buy Black Kids music back then, as Reggie says. Fantastic album. So many good tunes on the album, as we talked about on the record. And as we said, great to see that there's still so many people out there loving their music still today. They had a really successful UK tour, and he was blown away by the support that stood out there for the band.
And we tried to tease the possibility of new music out of him as well, Rich. So, have a listen to hear about that. Here's Reggie Youngblood from Black Kids on the Boys in the Band podcast.
This week on the Boys in the Band podcast, we're delighted to be joined by Reggie Youngblood from Black Kids. Thanks for joining us, Reggie. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Awesome, mate.
Yeah, very good over here. Thank you, mate. We'd like to kick off these podcasts, Reggie, with our sound check. Three quick fire questions to get us warmed up and raring to go. And first question is always, whereabouts are you?
I'm in Athens, Georgia.
Okay, Athens, Georgia. So you're from Florida originally, right? So
Jacksonville.
Yeah. So what takes you to Georgia?
Well, I guess if you live in the southeast of the states, Athens is the pretty obvious like music mecca. So this is where all the weirdos congregate. Yeah.
All the creatives.
Yeah, yeah. It's a pretty easy move from Florida.
Awesome. So our next question on the soundtrack is always, what are you listening to right now? So are you into any particular bands or artists at the minute?
Oh, wow. I just saw Always, and so I've been diving into their music again. last night, I just got, I don't know, I got blazed and I was just feeling nostalgic. So I put on some fucking AC/DC and it sounded so good. It sounded so good. Like for those about to rock, that is my jam.
Good stuff. Still rocking out. Okay. And final question, in the sound check. How was the UK tour, Reggie? Because you've just been over here and, how did it all go?
It was phenomenal. It was, I don't know. It definitely felt for me, and I think for everyone, like a pretty singular event. Yeah, it was so good. Yeah.
So yeah, you're over here just recently, and if we're winding the clock back to around 2008, when Party Traumatic made the top five on the album charts over here, and obviously the lead single that really took off over in the UK was I'm Not Going to Teach Your Boyfriend How to Dance With You. Massive, massive hit here. Loads of love for that record back then. So yeah, really good to see that the fans are still feeling the love 14 years on. What was the reception like when you were over here on tour?
It was great. One thing that surprised me that, well, there seemed to be like two types of people that came, like people who were fans, and I don't know, there's a lot of like people with their children, and their children had grown up on our record, which seemed absurd to me. But they're just like a lot of people who didn't like get to catch us the first time around. Yeah. And it was really special.
Awesome. Yeah. It says a lot about the band though, Reggie, that you can sort of command that audience and affection all these years on.
Yeah, I mean, we were all blown away and really touched. Like I thought that maybe most of the people at the show would be, you know, people who had seen us the first time and just were nostalgic, but it was really so many like younger people who were just like, I can't believe this is happening, that I'm getting to experience this record live. And I don't know, that blew me away more than anything else, that the record had just kind of like moved on to another generation. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. Cause well, me and Rich were, we can proudly say we were part of the first wave, because when you came over in December 2007, we were at the second show. We didn't make the first night, but we made the second night of that tour at Yulu, up in central London. A few months. Yeah. Just a few months after Wizard of Oz EP had come out. I can remember it. Yeah. Fantastic gig and excitement of seeing you guys as well. Sort of just having heard those early songs before the album was released as well. What do you remember? Because there was such a buzz about the band at that time as well, especially over here in the UK from our perspective.
Just about coming over that first time around, it was pretty surreal, as you can imagine. Especially since, like, in my mind, my best case scenario was that we'd become popular in the UK first, because I was such a Anglophile then, like, right. I think when I saw the Killers do it, I was just like, that's how you do it. You get big in the UK. And a previous band I was in before Black Kids, we actually played a show with the Killers and just inundated them with questions about what it was like over there. And so for like to see like my half-ass plan like become a reality, that was shocking.
I think it's always cool. I think, Rich, we've mentioned this before on the podcast with previous bands, that for it's such a big thing for British bands or English bands to try and break America. You know, it's always, you know, once they have a certain amount of success here, it's like, can you go and break America? But it's interesting when we speak to, you know, US bands and artists like yourself, there's almost this connection the other way, where there's this sort of a desire to break, not break the UK, but have an impact over here as well.
Yeah, I think I was just really into so many British bands at that time, like a lot of the Britpop, like New Order for sure, and Pet Shop Boys, but a lot of the Britpop stuff. And then some stuff that came a little later, like Hefner, just made a huge impact on me and so many kids in Jacksonville. And so we had like our own little scene where we were really into these groups. And I think that's what made me, I was like, oh, this is where I'll find my people. So if we can get over there, I just had an inkling that that would be the best scenario for us. But I mean, to break America, man, that just seems so daunting. And what an achievement when a English group does it. It's, I mean, touring America is hard. It's so much harder than touring the UK.
The big place.
Yeah, it's absurd.
Yeah, the sheer scale of the place. But we were looking back and sort of found a review of a gig just around that time that we saw you as well, and where the reviewer was saying that every song on the set sort of sounded like a single. And I think that was a great reflection of sort of your indie pop style. And interesting that you sort of had a plan to try and break or crack the UK first, and that worked out. So was the musical style you were after, was that something that you mapped out in the first place? Were you targeting that in sort of indie pop style to try and set out to achieve the UK domination?
We were just such, that record is just such a random mismatch of different things. In my head, I modeled the record after like a night out dancing. So yeah, when I started writing that record, I was probably in my mid-20s, and I just started going out and experiencing like dance nights. And I don't know, I was just always fascinated how if the DJ were good, he could go through all these different disparate genres. But if there's like, you know, a good DJ would find a way to link each song. And I think that's just kind of how I wanted our band to be. I wanted us to be able to genre hop, but for it all to make sense. And I think we achieved that on Party Traumatic. I took great care with the sequencing, but yeah, I mean, so yeah, that's kind of where my head was at. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, I suppose was the style, was where did that come from? You know, was that influences? Was that your part of the master plan?
Yeah, it was just like, as I said, I was really into these British groups, but also I was really into Prince and just like some R&B from the 90s that I grew up on. And I don't know, it's just like, that's all the stuff that got me off. It felt quite natural to just mix it all up, which yeah. I don't know. I feel like that was probably more jarring when our record came out, but it just seems so common to me today that a band will just do whatever they feel. And it's fine. No one really blinks an eye.
Yeah, nice. And I guess that would have lent itself as well to these live shows that, so me and Rich really enjoyed at that time. Those sort of punchy numbers as well, sort of 2-3 minute songs, and it was music to dance to, I guess, wasn't it?
Yeah, we did primarily think of ourselves as a dance group. I think we're moving into ballads next.
Part of your maturation.
Yeah,
mellowing out.
Yeah, 20 years later.
Oh, and a big interest. We'll tap into what comes next in a short while, Reggie. But the other thing I wanted to pick up on with you was there's a playfulness in those songs, certainly lyrically and musically as well. And certainly the titles as well. And I thought this was very much, when I was thinking about this, it's very much a sort of mid-2000s thing. We talked about, I'm not going to teach your boyfriend how to dance with you, that sort of, you know, that those sort of longer titles that we used to get back then, and the brackets as well, Underestimate My Charm Again, and Look at Me when I Rock With You. It's very much of that time, isn't it, those sort of song titles?
Yeah, I feel like I was mainly influenced by, again, the Pet Shop Boys. Like, they would have song titles like, You Only Tell Me You Love Me When You're Drunk, or I feel like I was heavily influenced by the Magnetic Fields, and so they always had ridiculous song titles. And often I would come up with the title first, like with I'm Not Going to Teach Your Boyfriend How to Dance With You. And then I would just be like, all right, that's a title I'm going to use for something. And eventually the song would come to me. Yeah, a title is a great impetus for a song. It just kind of, if you're lucky, the song will just write itself.
Yeah. What do you think, Rich, about sort of as an impact as a listener when you see, when you pick up an album back in the day there and you see those tracks listed out like that? For me, it's quite engaging and sort of makes you quite curious, I think, about where that song is going to take you.
Oh, yeah. I think I would think that too. If I only had the titles to go by, I would be like, well, this is obviously a ridiculous person. So, I mean, I'll risk $20 on this, I suppose.
We made USAA insurance to help you save. Take advantage of discounts when you cover your home and your ride. Discover how we're helping members save at usaa.com/bundle. USAA. Restrictions apply.
So what was your reaction then when the album did land and it was getting such positive reaction? You know, Pete mentioned the buzz sort of before the album came out, but when the album actually came out, the reaction in the music press and from the fans must have been a pretty wild experience for you guys.
It was. I mean, I don't know. I think things had been kind of crazy already at such for a while, where like the album being received well wasn't that much of a shock. I don't know, after a while, after everything was just like, yes, of course. I don't know, I maybe started to feel naively that like everything was going according to plan, and that like, yes, of course we're playing Glastonbury, of course we're doing late night shows, of course. I just thought that was par for the course, and so that should have been a moment where I should have been reflective, like we should have as a band looked at each other and been like, wow, we did it. But we were just moving along so fast that it really sometimes it's hard to register what was going on.
Yeah. When you're sort of in the eye of the storm, it just sweeps you guys along, I guess, doesn't it?
Truly.
Yeah. Did you get a sense of that time, sort of the sort of vibrant like indie scene that was around in that period? Because that's obviously the time that we reflect on in this podcast. And, you know, you toured with bands like Vampire Weekend, Kate Nash, Arcade Fire around that time. So 2008 was, you know, right in the middle of this sort of noughties indie boom that, you know, tons and tons of bands that me and Peter really into from that period. Did it feel like you were part of a scene?
It did. And, you know, I was really into like blogs, which were, so did you guys have blogs?
We had blogs, yeah.
Okay. All right. I had a sense that you guys might have had blogs. But yeah, just like all the blogs and websites, and I think I had a subscription to like NME, and so yeah, I was just taking all of that stuff in, and I was like hugely influenced by it, and I just felt like we were where we were supposed to be at that time.
Absolutely. So in terms of that impact of the album, as you say, it just felt like it was a natural progression for your band that was going so well.
I understand you were sort of working on the follow-up in 2010 and looking for a sort of a, to keep the, that momentum going. So what happened? Because it's a long delay, obviously, until the follow-up rookie in 2017.
Truly. I don't know. It's just the cliche of you have your whole life to write the first record. How many times have people said that on that podcast? on this podcast? You have forever to write your first record, and then you really have to, if you haven't been banking tunes the whole time, like a responsible artist, then you really have to like pull it out of your ass. And so after nearly 2 years of touring, we're back home finally, and which is a sort of culture shock in itself, because we haven't really been in Jacksonville. Jacksonville's changed. While we were gone, we were exhausted because we just toured ceaselessly. And I don't know. I think, it was a combination of exhaustion, not really liking each other very much, or just being in such close proximity, and just a lack of inspiration. It just wasn't fun, sadly. And I don't know, we gave it a good effort. I don't know. I have, when asked before, I've often joked that I'm lazy and that I just didn't feel like, but I don't know. I was just looking at some old demos on one of my old laptops, and they were just like, I was like, wow, this is a lot of stuff that just didn't work out and that we just weren't excited about. It wasn't for lack of trying.
So this is there an element of, you say you sort of, the theme of the album was maybe, you know, after a night out, that sort of youthfulness, and, you know, 2 years down the line when you've been touring, and it's maybe that moment in your life has moved on. So you can't really fabricate a second album of those same tunes. And then how do you develop that into your next chapter? I think there's lots of bands from that debut to the second album, that transition is really hard, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's astute. I at that moment, I was telling myself that I was more of a storyteller in my songs, but really, a lot of that is so much from life experience, and just touring on a bus for 2 years is not. I mean, it is an experience, but it's not, I don't know. I'm not writing songs about being on the road. I'm not Bon Jovi. I didn't realize that about myself, that I thought the songs were quite throwaway, but in retrospect, they were quite personal to me. And I don't know. Yeah, just going around playing shows and drinking the rider every night is not a compelling record.
But a good time.
Yeah. A good time was had.
So with that second record then, Reggie, obviously Pete mentioned a bit of a hefty delay between the two albums. So you talked about the difficult nature of trying to get into it initially. So what brought it back together? What was the sort of the catalyst for getting that second record made?
Well, though we had several failures, you know, going in doing demos that did not produce anything of note, we did eventually get bits and pieces that we liked. And because we weren't in the same city anymore, like we had dispersed, it took much longer for us to like get together and go over ideas. And so that just really made the process tedious, whereas before we were in the same scene, we lived in the same city, so much more natural to be in a room together. And yeah, so the distance physically, and that was definitely an issue. But I think just hitting our heads against the wall for long enough, you know, produce something.
And has this recent tour sparked desire to produce more new music?
And I think it's really, we don't have to make music through this group, I mean, we all play music apart from each other, but it's just that the past few tours that we've done have just been so lovely, just because we're just all, it's, you know, after we went through our horrible period, we just became a lot closer. And so it really is a joy to be with the others when we get together. And I feel like that is kind of my motivation to make another record, is because I'll get to spend time with them. It's, I mean, ambitions are gone. It's really about playing with them. And geez, I mean, meeting the people who came to see us was just so, so great. They were just, they were one, everyone was so wonderful. Yeah.
So what about these new ballads then you've been working on? you reference your sort of early phase was sort of tinged by Prince, say for example. So yeah. Who's the influence here with the ballads?
I don't know. Perhaps some Fleetwood Mac. I always did enjoy like a Morrissey type ballad. It'd be nice to hear something like that from someone who's not Morrissey, maybe. Maybe me. Yeah, that'd be great.
Perfect.
Someone else who likes a funky title as well to a song. He likes a quirky headline.
He does. And I've just blocked him out of my head. But he was everything to me. He was everything to me at one point. And so, yeah, that's all over our record.
Good stuff. Reggie, sort of quite a serious topic I just wanted to touch with you because, it's the Boys in the Band podcast, and we've made an effort to speak to females who are in this era. We're obviously named ourselves after a Libertine song that we love, one of our favourite bands from that era. But when we spoke to females who were in the scene at that time, it was very clear that they had obstacles to overcome and discrimination to fight against. Now, clearly the name of your band, Black Kids, it's not a huge leap to point out that there weren't loads of black guys making this sort of music back then. How did you find it being obviously as part of a band with that title in that era as well?
It did raise a lot of questions, mainly the question of being why have you named your band this?
Yeah.
And I kind of had a sense of the reasoning behind it, but I always had a really difficult time articulating like why I would call our group this. And it's only been in retrospect that I kind of could take into account like where I was in my life. I was kind of reaching a point in my life where I kind of was having a hard time ignoring like racism directed towards me. Whereas before, I think I just would willfully ignore it because I didn't want to have to deal with it. And I would just move on. But it kind of got to a point where I couldn't ignore it anymore. And that was around the time we started Black Kids. And so, I don't know, it seemed to me that in certain rooms, that's all we were. We were the band that had a black lead singer. That's how I was viewed. That's how I was treated. And I just kind of wanted to just put that like up front to, I don't know, it just made me feel like I had some kind of control of the narrative. If I was just like, yes, I'm a black person doing this type of music. And but I just really didn't have, and I still don't have the vocabulary to describe what I was feeling.
It's not, I mean, we've had a fun chat all the way through, but I just felt it was an important sort of thing to touch on, because I think, you know, it's easy for me and Rich to, yeah, and we noticed that really speaking, you know, to the girls who rocked out during that period as well. Just, it was something that probably never occurred to us at the time, really, that, you know, there's not many girls playing at the moment, but there's not many black guys making this music. But the more you think about it, that's the issue, isn't it? That we don't maybe notice these things, and then people who butt up against, you know, people like yourself, you feel that, and people like me and Rich who love that music or that scene or that industry at that time don't notice the damage that can be done as well. So I just wanted to flag it, really.
No, cheers. Yeah. I mean there were lighter reasons that I also the name appealed to me. I mean, it doesn't seem like a real band would call themselves Black Kids. Like, I don't know. It has like a sort of like fictional TV band. I don't know, like some weird 90s movie where there would be a fake band. And so I don't know. Yeah, it's just, it felt a bit trollish to me as well. Kind of confrontational, I guess. It's certainly, I don't, created awkward moments for the white people in the group.
Yeah, I think it goes back to a little bit like that playful nature we were talking about earlier, you know, that kind of rebellious side. You want to be, you know, dare to be different.
Yeah, I was dealing with some issues that were definitely causing me frustration in my life. But yeah, I just also am just like a prick, like an edgelord. So that was part of it for me too.
Good stuff, Reggie. Thank you for talking about that. We'll wrap up, Reggie, with our three final questions, a bit more lighthearted. The first one is, what's the best gig that you've that the Black Kids have done so far? Because hopefully there'll be plenty more good ones to come as well on the back of that tour.
Oh, wow, that's so easy. It was our most recent show in London at the 100 Club.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. My God. It was so special. It was amazing. Yeah, I didn't know that this place existed. I think one of the downsides of playing those larger venues the first time we were in the UK was that we didn't get to experience the mid-size venues, which I feel like have so much more character. Like, I didn't know about Brudenell Social Club or 100 Club. I mean, those are my favorite types of places to play. And yeah, 100 Club was just insane. And our producer, Bernard Butler, made it out. And so it was rad to reconnect with him. So yeah, just a special night all around.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, love that venue. Next up in the Encore, Reggie, do you have a pinch me moment that you remember from your time where you just couldn't quite believe where you got to?
it was when we were working with Bernard Butler, because I was such a huge Suede fan, and this guy was like the guitarist of his generation, and I'm playing guitar in front. I'm a mediocre guitarist. I was like, I don't believe I'm playing guitar in front of this man. So yeah, that was special for me.
Very good. And last one, Reggie, what's the song you're proudest of?
It's so basic, but I can't help but be proud of I'm Not Going to Teach Your Boyfriend How to Dance with You, because it is just the kind of song that I love. It's just pure sugar. It's the kind of song, and I think that's, I love finding a song like that and just running it into the ground. And I look for similar songs that just are absurd and just make you ask why. Why did they think that was okay to do this? I don't know. Yeah, that gives me a lot of joy.
Yeah, certainly does to many of us, Reggie. Absolutely love that record, love the album, and really appreciate you giving us your time tonight to reminisce, to get a bit nostalgic over the old days and talk about the recent tour and yeah, this potential upcoming new music too. So yeah, been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you guys. I think you guys took my podcast virginity. This was a joy.
Yeah. Oh, wow. We're honored.
When you save on auto insurance for driving safe with USAA Safe Pilot, you'll feel like a big deal. Even in a traffic jam. Save up to 30% with USAA Safe Pilot. Restrictions apply.